you there? We are okay. Live.
Adventures in Live Radio. Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots, where anything can happen and probably will. Our producer is in Lexington, Kentucky, where they are currently experiencing weirdnesses with the electrical grid. We may or may not do this whole show before getting knocked off the air. In the meantime, it's Friday, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gray Donis. Hello, how you doing here on Connecting the Dots, Steve?
I'm doing okay. Happy to be here. Happy to be on the air.
Good.
You know, in spite of the glitches, and hopefully we will get to talk for close to an hour and talk about a lot of stuff.
All right, cool. Yes. Well, you know, we could talk about the devastating impact that tuna melt sandwiches have on the electrical grid in Lexington, Kentucky. I've done this before going on the air, too. I've, like, wolfed down my lunch because I got to be on the air talking in 3 minutes. So Steve was eating his tuna melt, and then all of a sudden the power went out. I blame the tuna melt. So
it's the way it goes. So, it was a good tuna melt. It was worth it.
Okay. All right. We'll overlook it this time. So you know what does it? It's the mercury in the tuna.
Ah, yes.
It screws up the electrical grid. So what's new? How's things?
So, there are a couple of interesting new movies in theaters this weekend that I have reviews for, and we're going to talk about them both, and we can talk about disaster movies and heroism and how that's portrayed in the movies in relation to Deepwater Horizon.
Okay.
And we can talk about Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children and the odd saga of Tim Burton at the movies.
Okay.
Somebody did a critique of Pixar's Inside Out. They talked about its portrayal of human nature and how they feel that it distorts humanity. And so I wrote an essay on that. We can talk about that too.
Okay. I hope it was a tart rebuttal. That's because I'm a fan of Inside Out, but that's all right. Yeah, well, that sounds good. I'm a big fan of disaster movies because I grew up in the 70s, mm-hmm. and there was like this whole slew of these things. And it really started with Airport,
right?
Which was actually, I think Airport came out in like the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really like the first movie. One of the things that it did was that it really encouraged something that just took off, if you'll pardon the pun, after that, which was hijacking airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting on an air. People just hadn't thought about, what if some guy got on an airplane with a bomb? You know, and what happens if the bomb goes off? You know, and so that's kind of what Airport was about. But there was like this whole slew of these disaster movies. You know, there was the Towering Inferno and the Poseidon Adventure and Earthquake. And there was a whole ton of these things in the 70s. Deepwater Horizon it's not that kind of disaster movie because it's.
No,
it's not involving large populations of people being threatened or anything like that.
It belongs to a species of film that somebody has called the docubuster, that is the documentary blockbuster. And it's not really a documentary, but it is based on a true story, the true story of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, otherwise known as the BP oil spill or the Deepwater Horizon oil spill of 2010.
Right.
And we read and we heard for weeks about how it was the worst environmental disaster in American history and how many millions of gallons of oil were being pumped into the water, and as well as all the dispersants and the impact of all of that. But, mm-hmm. you know, somewhat overlooked for many of us, particularly those of us who weren't, you know, in the area. Mm-hmm. Was the human impact of the initial catastrophe, the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig, which was this monstrous floating island of concrete and steel that was not supposed to pump oil. It was just supposed to drill, but there were technical problems, and there were massive safety systems in place, all of which failed spectacularly on this very terrible day. And the result was a massive blowout and a fireball that was, you know, so high up in the sky that it could be seen 40 miles away. And of the 126 souls on board that day, 11 perished, and many others were seriously injured. And but most of them survived, and some of them acquitted themselves heroically, and some of them, particularly the two guys, the two BP executives, faced charges. They probably should have been punished, but they didn't. And so this is that story.
It's always a relief when powerful executives don't face consequences.
Yes, you know?
I feel that way about Wells Fargo too. I'm just so relieved that all the upper echelon guys have not faced any consequences except in front of Congress. But
that's the way it goes, and that's the way it goes in the film. The film does take significant efforts, in spite of the fact that it is very much a Hollywood film with, you know, big stars like Mark Wahlberg. It does make an effort to be very accurate to what happened and what it was like. They built this incredible, like, 85% scale model, and they built full size sets for other parts of the Deepwater Horizon, and there's a lot of effort went into making it authentic.
Okay, interesting. That sounds worth seeing. I'm still trying to get my wife. I'm trying to arrange a time to go see the Queen of Katwe from your recommendation last week.
Yes, and there's a connection between these two movies.
Oh, okay.
Both of them are based on a true story.
Ah, well, okay.
Both of them have a lead actor who is a devout Christian. David Oyelowo, who stars as Robert Katende, the chess coach in Queen of Katwe, is a devout Christian. And Mark Wahlberg, the star of Deepwater Horizon, is a devout Catholic. He makes sure that he hoped that, you know, we were reading in the news recently about how production halts on Sundays so that he can go to Mass and so that other people can get to Mass or go to church.
Yeah.
And there's a scene in the film. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There's a scene in the film where all the characters who have survived go down on their knees as the Deepwater Horizon is burning, and they all say the Our Father, and they say the whole prayer. It cuts away after and deliver us from evil so that we don't have to find out if these are Catholics or Protestants. But I wondered whether Mark Wahlberg might have been responsible for that scene being there, the way that Oyelowo was responsible for the scene where he prays with his students. That was an ad lib. That wasn't in the script, but Oyelowo wanted it in there. Okay. So the scene, he'd seen a photograph of the real Katende praying with the kids, and so the scene went in there. And I wonder if Wahlberg had some similar input.
That's interesting. Yeah, I was talking to Rod Bennett on Wednesday, and he was talking about the way in which Peter Cushing's very serious Anglo-Catholic faith impacted some of the, like, the Dracula movies that he worked on. Which I did not know about. So there was, like, one of the films that he made, it was, I forget the title of the film, but it was something where, you know, the hero is fighting evil. As the script had it, they, like, decide, well, we got to fight fire with fire. And so they, you know, the hero, like, summons the, you know, the powers of darkness and prays to Satan or something in order to defeat evil. And Cushing is like, no, that's not how this is done. And it was funny because the executives behind the film were like, we don't really care about any of this stuff. We're just making a movie on a $10,000 budget. So if you want to change it, take the script home and change it if you want. So Cushing basically went home with the script and rewrote it. so that it would reflect, you know, Bram Stoker's, you know, habit of bringing in Christian themes and so forth.
It's funny that you mention that because, my daughter Anna, who's doing a reading for her homeschooling co-op, she's doing a reading from Dracula, and it focuses on the religious themes in one scene.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah,
because it's all over the place, of course, in Dracula, and Stoker brings that in, and there's stuff that's like kind of sketchy from a Catholic perspective.
Sure,
like cramming the Eucharist into
some putty.
It's a body to keep
crumbling it. Yeah.
Yeah. To keep the demon from getting out of to keep the vampire from getting out of the tomb is like,
but he says it's okay because he has an indulgence. An indulgence.
Sure. Yeah. That's one of those things that you can find those documents in the basement of the Vatican. Everybody knows this.
Yes. Hollywood.
Yep. Well, I think we're coming up against a break. I'm not hearing any bump music. Ethan.
Oh, there it is.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Here today with Mr. Stephen Gradonis, and we were talking a little bit about Deepwater Horizon, the new film about Deepwater Horizon catastrophe, and just that genre of disaster movie. I think part of the appeal, of course, of disaster movies is they provide you with a chance to imagine how you wouldn't do all the dumb things that people in disaster movies do. Lead up to, if I was there, I would never have done this stupid thing, you know, or this cowardly thing. There's something appealing about that. Plus, of course, you get to watch a lot of things blow up and burn. And
right. Well, and in this case, it's very important that director Peter Berg coming to this story, because it's based on a true story and it happened only 6 years ago. And, you know, the vast majority of the people who weren't among the 11 that were killed are still alive, and their families and everything.
Right.
Deepwater Horizon really wants to honor these people that do this roughneck thing, this going out into the middle of the ocean and drilling for oil, and you know, at the same time lay all of the blame on the villainous BP executives. One of whom is played by John Malkovich, and he's just deliciously evil in an entirely quirky way that only John Malkovich could pull off.
Okay.
But for the most part, it is a story of decent salt of the earth people who, a lot like Sully in that movie, you know, didn't set out to be heroes or to do anything heroic, but found themselves thrust into a catastrophic situation where heroism was called for, and many of them rise to heroism.
Yeah.
And I just think it's interesting that at a time when, as we've discussed in the past, our traditionally heroic characters, you know, the superheroes, they have become much more ambiguous and conflicted and tortured. And many of them are, you know, just out and out anti-heroes or genuinely unlikable characters, or even in the case of Suicide Squad, actual bad guys.
Right.
Right. So we have to look to like blue collar workers and people working on oil rigs and people flying airplanes, ordinary people, for that inspiration that in a moment of crisis, you know, it is possible to do the right thing and even to rise to true heroism.
Well, I think that's a net win, really. And not merely because it does affirm everything that I've tried to tell you about superheroes. But anyway, but I do think that there's something good. One of the things that I appreciated, and it comes from an unlikely source, actually, Christopher Nolan, in The Dark Knight, is you have that climax, you know, where the Joker is saying, you know, his whole ethos has been if you put these people in the wrong place, they will eat each other.
Right.
And his whole experiment is setting out to prove that that's what will happen. And at the climax of this film by one of the more nihilistic filmmakers.
Yes.
Out there.
and a film that is full of nihilism.
It's full of nihilism and just incredibly dark. It doesn't happen.
Right.
At the climax of the film, ordinary people do the right thing. And, you know, Batman doesn't save the day. He's too busy just, you know, dangling. He's too busy being tempted by nihilism, you know, dangling the Joker over the abyss and so on and so forth. But it was the same thing that we saw on 9/11. I think one of the most moving things for me about 9/11 was the way in which the citizenry of New York, I mean, just rose to the occasion.
Yeah.
In incredible ways, you know? I mean, the whole city just kind of organized itself into this giant humanitarian effort. You had homeless people out there directing traffic because there was no one else to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I was never prouder of my country or the people of New York than on that day. And it wasn't because there were superheroes. It was just because there were ordinary people doing everything that they could, you know, and that included, of course, the first responders, hundreds of whom were killed because while everybody else was going down the stairs, they were going up.
Right.
And yep. It's just, yeah. So that's the attraction of this film for me, actually, is exactly that you're seeing ordinary people doing the right thing, you know, at the risk and cost of their lives.
And I think that it's interesting that in spite of the fact that you have Hollywood stars cast in these roles, people like Mark Wahlberg and Kurt Russell, and Kate Hudson plays Mark Wahlberg's wife, Felicia, and they are recognizable Hollywood types. You know, Wahlberg plays this tough, smart hero. He's self-effacing. He's a family man. Very decent guy, and his beautiful wife and his adorable young daughter exist to reinforce to us, the viewers, that, you know, his life is really important and he really has to get home to his two beautiful ladies. And the daughter, adorably, she wants a baby brother. So, you know, there are these Hollywood shortcuts and these screenwriting hacks that they use to create a cinematic experience that is easily accessible to the masses. And yet it's interesting to me that the characters aren't much developed beyond those types, because the story isn't really about them as characters. It's about their actions and it's about their experiences. It's about what happens to them. And, you know, that's what saves it from being something like James Cameron's Titanic. Apart from the fact that in Titanic, there is no heroism or selflessness on behalf of strangers. That's one of the most terrible things about that film. But also, mm-hmm. you know, the trumped up romance between Kate and Leo is supplants the essence of the story. And that doesn't, nothing like that happens in Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that one then. That's what I want to see.
But I do think
what else?
I just want to, just to close out Deepwater Horizon, I do want to say I think it's important that we see that Wahlberg's character is a family man, and that his relationship with his wife and his daughter and the possibility of them having another child are all just kind of taken for granted, and they're part of what makes him, what makes these people, you know, decent, wholesome, ordinary human beings is yeah. their family milieu and the life-giving love of their relationship. And the faith aspect, which comes through in a few places, I think somebody makes the sign of a cross, and there's that Our Father that everybody prays at the end.
Yeah.
I don't know who was responsible for putting that prayer in, but I think it's significant that a character like an actor like Wahlberg, who's a devout Catholic, you know, he's working on the film. And I do know that creative people make different decisions based on their life experiences and their identities and their beliefs. And so, mm-hmm. for instance, with Queen of Katwe, you know, you have a film that's set in Uganda with an all-black cast and a positive depiction of people of faith. Would the film have been made if it hadn't been for Tendo Nagenda, who was Disney's senior creative executive at the time, who is of Ugandan descent? If he hadn't made that move, would this story set in Uganda have been depicted? But also, would the film's depiction of the religious characters be what it is without Oyelowo and his faith?
Right.
You know? So people make different decisions, and so diversity and representation off screen affects what we see on the screen. And when you have people of different backgrounds, including people of faith, you know, you get something richer on screen.
Right. And it really is the case. I remember, you know, culture really matters. I live in Seattle, the least church city and the least church state in the nation. And I've taken trips down to the south, down to Alabama for various things. I've been at EWTN or whatnot, or you stop at some grocery store and you walk into the grocery store, and it's just a matter of course that there are big book racks there by the checkout stand full of, you know, Christian books. That's unthinkable in Seattle. You know, someone would like call the ACLU about something. This is trigger warning in Seattle, but it's just part of the culture in the South. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, you know, overt Christian piety, and if it comes to that, also of course Muslim piety, it's just part of the atmosphere in Africa. And so the things that would embarrass a Seattleite, somebody just you know, grabbing hands and praying publicly or something like that, that wouldn't get into a movie made by somebody from Seattle because it's not the done thing.
Right.
The creators of that film recognize that it's perfectly normal, the done thing. And it's something that happens, of course, in other parts of the U.S. as well. Well, we will continue... We'll continue this conversation when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. And we'll be back on Red Box Media talking about life at the movies right after this.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Connect Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. If you want to give us a call, we're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also text us at that number, too, and you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. So, what else is going on out in the Bijou?
So, Tim Burton is back. And he has a movie that is based on a young adult novel called Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. And you may have noticed that Tim Burton is a peculiar man.
Yeah. With
peculiar tastes.
You,
who likes making peculiar movies about peculiar people.
Yes, it is a trait that I have noticed.
Well, in this case, I while I was watching the film, I just couldn't help thinking how much more peculiar this movie would have been if it had come out in 1999.
Okay. Why 1999?
Well, I thought of 1999 in the first place because it was a great year for film. And films have gotten really bad. And it struck me as interesting that a film that I thought was kind of mediocre in 2016 might be more interesting if you put it in a better year for film. Why would that be? Well, the reason is because it tells the story of a group of curiously gifted children with that kind of, is it a gift or is it a curse thing?
Okay.
Who come together from different places, and they live in a secret establishment apart from the rest of the world.
Wait a minute. This is the X-Men.
Well, what else is it? Under the guidance of a wise and powerful mentor with a British accent. Is this right?
Yes.
So it's like Harry Potter meets the X-Men.
Okay,
Yeah, and well, the X-Men franchise began in 2000, and Harry Potter began in 2001. And, you know, the movie just seemed not all that peculiar to me for the most part. It seemed kind of staid and predictable, and it unfolded more or less the way that I thought it would. Asa Butterfield plays a young man named Jake, whose grandfather has these crazy stories about when he was a peculiar and he lived with these peculiars, and they hunted monsters in Germany, or not in Germany, in Poland. But it has a German connection because he was a Polish Jew. His name was Abraham. And the monsters were called hologasts, or as they say it in the film, hologasts. Yeah.
I think I'm figuring this out. Okay.
Yeah, so I think there's a metaphor here.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it kind of bumps along as you'd expect. Jake goes and he looks up the home for peculiar children and he finds them and they're still there. And it's actually still 1943 because time travel, that's always fun. But then after being not all that weird or bizarre or peculiar.
No, I just have to say something that
yeah.
if you're capable of time travel, Poland 1943 is like not the place I would stay.
Okay, so I wasn't being clear. They're actually on an island off the coast of Wales.
Okay.
They tried to pick a perfect place.
And
you're supposed to pick a perfect day. And what they do, people like Miss Peregrine, who's played by Eva Green, have the power to create a 24-hour time loop. And you just keep living in the same day over and over. It's like Groundhog Day.
Okay.
It's like Groundhog Day if Phil got his dream day. That's the idea.
Okay. Well, it sounds like we have a caller, so I'd like to welcome our caller. Hello?
Hello, Mark. Steven?
Hi.
Hi, this is Evan from Connecticut. Evan. I don't know if...
Hey, Evan.
Hi, I was calling to ask specifically, obviously, about... Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
Yes.
And what I was wondering is, I will try to be as vague as possible because the ending of the novel, which, by the way, is not that good. Your review, Steve, sounds like the movie has all the same problems that the book had. But but what the end of the novel basically ends with a crisis unresolved to set up multiple sequels. I was wondering, does the movie stand on its own, or does the movie do the same thing that the book does?
It does not follow the book in that regard. Now, I haven't read the book, but based on your very vague description, I'm going to say that the book and the movie end quite differently. There is a very significant threat in the course of the film, which is resolved by the end of the film. And while the sequel potential is certainly there, the movie ends with a kind of a forward-looking premise. But there is no crisis, no specific crisis that needs to be addressed by the end of the film.
Okay. Yeah, so then they definitely change it. Although my guess is the crisis is probably similar, even though they resolve it in the movie, it sounds like.
Okay. So, anything else?
No, just wondering. I know you're not the biggest Tim Burton fan, but I was wondering, how would you say it holds up in his work overall?
You know, it's funny. I kept being reminded while I was watching of other Tim Burton films, and I mentioned some of that in my review. And it's funny because some of these things clearly come from the book. It's not something. It's not like Tim Burton is just transferring his own personal fetishes and things that he's done in movies like Big Fish and Frankenweenie and other movies onto this, but maybe he was drawn to the material because those resonances were already there. So I found it fairly unremarkable late Tim Burton for the most part. Now, when the content kind of goes off the rails and the movie really ratchets up into weirdo territory, I think this is where true Tim Burton aficionados are going to, they're going to just, it's going to be like catnip for them. Not being a Tim Burton fan of that caliber, but being willing to be persuaded by the better examples. I really like Frankenweenie. I liked Frankenweenie. I thought Frankenweenie worked really well. I'm also a big fan of Corpse Bride. So maybe it's his stop motion that works better for me than his live action these days. But I found it underwhelming, and ultimately to me it failed for me because I couldn't imagine myself as the movie's ideal audience. For the most part, I thought it played like other movies this year that we've seen, movies like The BFG and Pete's Dragon, kind of Tony movies that would play well to smart kids who don't need to have explosions thrown at them every 5 seconds. But then the movie ratchets up into these incredibly gross, grotesque story elements, and suddenly I'm thinking, well, I can't bring my kid to that. So it kind of fell between two stools for me.
Well, yeah, it's funny you mentioned the who's the audience, because I felt the same way reading the book, because I was reading it. It's like a fifth, sixth grade reading level. And then all of a sudden there's these gruesome, creepy passages, all these vulgarities thrown in, and I'm just like, what? I was even asking myself, who's the audience for this book?
Right. So the book has been labeled young adult, but you say that it's aimed at about a sixth grade reading level. And I think that that's what's basically happening here. I begin to suspect, at least with this movie, it seems like Burton might be, you know, basically making the movie for his inner 12-year-old. And that is a particular, like, I think I'm very much in touch with my inner 8-year-old. And I'm on speaking terms with my inner 15-year-old, but the inner 12-year-old and I just don't get along. And when it feels to me like a movie is aiming at that specific age, maybe I'm just not the right critic for the job.
Now, one of the questions I constantly ask myself is, it happened, I think, sometime in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
But suddenly, it was not a children's movie unless you had fart jokes. There had to be fart gags all the time, and it was like, why is this a children's thing?
Well, body humor is body function humor is a universal source of humor. It's part of every culture.
I get that. I guess what I mean is, why is it de rigueur? I mean,
yes,
if it's a kids movie, there's got to be fart jokes. And it's
right.
Like, okay, you know. Why?
And just then one step down the chain is what I apparently invented this critical term in my review of the movie Flushed Away. I it was such a pervasive feature of the film that I had to give it a name, and so I called it crotch trauma humor.
Well, okay.
And I've seen other critics use it since then. So I feel like I've contributed something to the critical community. Crotch trauma humor. It's one step below flatulence humor for me in the family film playbook.
Okay. Well, yeah. Just, we're going to put that in the movie lexicon right next to Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
So right, right. So. My claim to fame.
Yes. I knew you win. I just want to ride on your Learjet now that you've you just patent that. You get a quarter every time somebody uses it. So.
Well, thanks for the call, Evan.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Good talk. All right.
All right. Very good. Well, we're running up against the break here, but we'll keep talking about Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we'll be back right after this.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We've been talking a bit about Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, the new Tim Burton film.
But let's change it up and finish up the segment talking about Inside Out.
All right, cool.
Yeah. So I found it interesting to engage this article on Inside Out and to talk about its critique of the film's portrayal of human nature and what it includes and specifically what it doesn't include, because I think that there's a larger point here in the way that we engage art and what we expect from art. Mm-hmm. So there was an article at a website called The Imaginative Conservative. It is not a website that I have frequented. And on this particular occasion, I only discovered the essay by a Presbyterian pastor and culture commentator named C.R. Wiley, because one of my alert readers sent it to me and asked me what I thought about it. And I said, I can knock out what I think about it, you know, very quickly and put it up on Crux, and it'll be a really interesting piece. Okay. I don't know that it's really interesting, but I thought it was interesting. And what it comes down to is this. Yes, you can critique Inside Out for distorting human nature. There is an element of truth to the claim, because it is a movie that focuses on the role of emotions in our personhood. And although it explores other aspects of our inner experience, things like memory and the subconscious, and there's a brief scene with abstract thought and so forth, it's fundamentally about joy and sadness.
Right.
And if you can absolutely look at the first. Hey,
Dan, we're back on the air.
Back on the air. So for those of you who stuck with us through that 30 seconds of silence or whatever it was that you heard, we are talking about Inside Out and an article which argues that Inside Out portrays a truncated or a distorted picture of human nature, and specifically that the emotions drive Riley, and that there's no the article points out that where is conscience, where is moral decision, and that's a fair question. And also, you could say, where is reason, where is rational judgments of any kind, not just moral, and what about free will? There's one little indication of free will where Anger tries to give her the idea to run away from home. And he puts the idea symbolized by a light bulb up to the control panel, and it sinks into the control panel on its own. And he says, she took it. She took the idea. So she had apparently the freedom to take it or not take it. Mm-hmm. But that's all. So, okay, yes. Inside Out is a movie about emotions, and specifically it's a movie about joy and sadness. So there are aspects of the human experience that are not illuminated by the film. Okay. This guy said, well, you know, you want to see a movie about conscience? Watch Pinocchio, Jiminy Cricket, Conscience and Body. That's where it's at. Okay. Well, okay, but where is emotion in Pinocchio, or where is reason in Pinocchio? Here's an idea. Why don't we watch Pinocchio and Inside Out instead of pitting them against each other?
Well, yeah, and that's my response to it too, is just really what they're saying is, why didn't they make a movie about everything?
Right.
Well, because they were making a movie about emotion. And, you know, it does what it sets out to do and does it, I think, very, very well. You know, there's other aspects that are completely left out of the film too, because they make a choice to make a film about an 11-year-old girl and not a, you know, a 25-year-old woman or a 25-year-old man. So there's up until the end where we meet, you know, that kid, there's no mention of a sex drive either.
Right.
You know, that doesn't enter into
girl.
Yeah.
Girl.
I love that kid, right?
So I think that our critic C.R. Wiley of the Imaginative Conservative, I think that he goes somewhat wrong, although he has a valid point. He goes somewhat wrong in his reading of Inside Out, because he's coming to it, and maybe it's because he's a Presbyterian pastor. No offense to any of my Presbyterian friends who are listening, but he comes to it looking for what he calls a moral, and he's not looking for what I look for in a movie, which is not necessarily a moral, but for insight, for understanding into human nature. And there is a profound message, a profound insight in Inside Out, which comes as a revelation to many parents at a certain point, which is, you watch your children when they're little and they're sweet, and they have this simple, pure happiness and this joy, and it's just transparent. And then something happens, and they become moody and withdrawn. And, right. You know, you feel like, did you screw up as a parent? What happened to that, to your kid? What happened to your happy boy or your happy girl? And the reality is that the world becomes more complicated as you grow up. And sadness and happiness become inextricably intertwined, and sadness plays a greater part in life. And it's important to recognize that and to accept. And it's just, that's the world we live in.
Right. Yeah. And I thought it was just so beautiful, you know, at the end, you know, when you start getting the balls that are mixtures of, you know, colors, as she begins to appreciate that fact that joy and sadness can go together. Golly, what a lovely movie. Now it makes me want to go back and watch it again.
Yeah, it really, I would say that Inside Out in my top 10 film lineup of last year, it was my number two film.
Mm.
And if I've never put together a list of my top 10 American animated films, but if I did, Inside Out would certainly be on the list. And I'm not sure that it wouldn't make my top 10 animated films of all time altogether.
Yeah, it really is just a brilliant piece of work. It really is. I got to ask you, just before we go, have you seen The Magnificent Seven?
I was just asked that recently by my dad. He was wondering if he should go see it, and I have not. I missed the screening, and I haven't had a chance to catch up with it. I will say that, you know, what I told my dad was, go see Sully. I know you'll like that. I couldn't necessarily recommend The Magnificent Seven, but Sully is great, and Queen of Katwe is great, and Deepwater Horizon is also worth seeing. And so after a pretty miserable summer, there are a few films out there in theaters.
You know what I'm looking forward to? I don't know if you've seen the trailer for it, but I'm really looking forward to Arrival.
Ah, no, I haven't seen the trailer.
Oh, okay. It looks like it's just going to be great. I've seen some reviews of it. It's been shown, I guess, at some film festivals in Europe or something.
I am really impressed with the trailer for the upcoming Mel Gibson film for Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah, I'd like to see that too. I think that's going to be great. It's all of a sudden, you know, after this miserable summer, all these great movies are popping up.
Well, it just goes to show that, you know, the Hollywood's blockbuster mode, it's kind of tentpole summer mode, is really broken, much too dependent on remakes.
Superhero movies.
Yes, superhero movies. Although, Captain America: Civil War, we just watched it, and I have to say, the airport scene in that movie is one of the best things I have ever seen. Have you seen it?
Wait, refresh my memory.
Captain America, you've got Captain
Iron Man,
and Ant-Man becomes Giant Man, and Black Widow, and Hawkeye are, you know, and Spider-Man! Spider-Man! And then he is
the fangirling.
The best Peter Parker, and arguably, I think I have to say, after watching it twice, I think it's the best screen incarnation of Spider-Man that I have seen yet. So,
it is.
And have you seen the trailer for Scott Derrickson's Doctor Strange?
Yes.
Because, oh my goodness. That looks like that could be something. That looks like it could really blow the doors off of not necessarily how a Marvel movie is structured, but what a Marvel movie is expected to look like.
Well, I got to admit, you know, old Benny Cumberbatch, he was born to play Doctor Strange. I mean,
much more so, I think, than Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways you're right, although he's awfully good there, too. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, Deacon Stephen Gradonis. You can find his work at decentfilms.com and Crocs, the National Catholic Register. Our producer today was Ethan Boland. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and I will be back on Monday with Sherry Antonetti. Until then, have a great weekend. Bye-bye.